Always stay connected with 99.9% reliable Sky Broadband. Search Sky Broadband to get started.
Hello and welcome to Inside Politics, the politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Pat Leahy. I'm joined this morning by my colleagues on the political team, Jack Horgan-Jones and Harry McGee. Gentlemen, welcome. In a little while, we'll talk about the politics of climate action and the political challenges facing the coalition as the Greens seek to secure the agreement of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for deep cuts to greenhouse gas emissions in the agriculture sector. But first, the government this week moved swiftly to tighten Ireland's immigration and asylum regime when it revoked automatic permission to enter Ireland for people granted asylum in other European countries. Jack, this happened rather quickly and abruptly via an incorporeal cabinet meeting where ministers are essentially rung up and asked to assent to a decision without any discussion. And it reflects the growing alarm in government at the rising numbers of Ukrainians and other people seeking asylum in Ireland and the strain all that is putting on the state's facilities and processes for dealing with those arriving here. Just run us through what happened first.
So in the first instance, the decision that was taken on Monday afternoon, the first thing to note is it doesn't actually affect anyone arriving from Ukraine. It's targeted rather at a group of people the government have decided are effectively abusing or misusing a pre-existing system which allows for visa-free travel for people who have been granted refugee status in one of 20 European countries. And effectively, it's kind of designed to allow for kind of temporary family reunification, seeing people that you might know from your home country for periods up to 3 months. And it means that if you live in one of these countries and you're in receipt of refugee status, you can turn up at the border of another country, Ireland or wherever, and stay there for up to 3 months. What they've done is they've now mandated that you can't do that anymore, that you need a visa. And they've done that for two reasons, basically. In the first instance, because they feel that people are either travelling on forged documents, and the government was told in a memo that was circulated to ministers that the Border Management Unit is satisfied that there is instances of forgery, so people just gaining access to the country. And then in the second instance, that people are coming here on genuine documents, but then either at the airport not presenting those documents and applying for international protection there, or at a later date at the International Protection Office in Dublin City Centre, turning up and applying for international protection there. The suggestion, or the implicit suggestion, being that there's some form of jurisdiction shopping going on, that there are either pull factors associated with Ireland and the system that we have for refugees here, or push factors associated with other jurisdictions where people have already been awarded refugee status, push factors such as, you know, a change in their refugee status, potentially being in the offing or changing their working allowances, or, you know, perhaps their conditions of residency or their accommodation acting as push factors. But basically, why I think this matters really is not so much the kind of nitty gritty of the decision. It's more when you talk to people in government and officials in justice on background or off the record, they're saying, look, this does make a small difference. And, you know, given the pressures that the system is under, that matters. But really what we're at here is sending a wider signal, trying to put across the message that, you know, while Ireland had kind of demobilized some of the more blunt or coercive measures when it came to migration policy, such as, you know, standing down deportations and stopping issuing negative decisions on applications during COVID, they're now starting to kind of to remobilize all those different things in an effort to push that message out that Ireland is not a soft touch. All of this arising from the generalised pressure that the immigration and integration and reception systems are under, both from a huge uptick in your common or garden international protection applicants, you know, your people fleeing conflict or situations where they can't reside in their own home country anymore, and the 40,000 odd people who have come here from Ukraine, which has combined to put the system under immense pressure.
Essentially, from what you say, it sounds like they are trying to toughen up Ireland's international protection stroke asylum regime in order to reduce the numbers of people coming here in the first instance. Is that it in a nutshell?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, that I don't think you can separate out the fact that, you know, this measure would seemingly only reduce the numbers on the international protection list by about 7%, which is not massive. Now, when you're running a system which is so close to tipping over, 7% does make a difference.
But that assumes, sorry to cut across you, Jack, but that assumes presumably, right, that this 7% who are now required to have visas before they can enter Ireland, that assumes that they will be refused visas, does it?
Or it assumes that they just might not come because, you know, the visa process might prove too unwieldy. You know, you do have to prove, I think, that you have a job in your country of residence, that you have an inbound and outbound flight. I mean, I think it presumes that it's going to lower that number quite substantially, and also that it will lower the number of people who are seeking to join people here who may have abused or misused that system. And there is, as I say, a sense in government that that is a contributory factor to the numbers coming on to the international protection list. But to come back to the main point, even in the aggregate, even if you threw the kind of broadest kind of net over this possible, you're not going to come up with a number of people the removal of which is going to make a massively substantial, earth-shattering difference to the size of the problem. So that's why I think you can't get away from, while it won't hurt in terms of taking pressure off a system that is very close to tippling over at any given point, as we saw with people sleeping on the floor of Dublin Airport's old terminal building, it won't hurt, but I think it's more about the signal and talking to people in government as well over Monday, Tuesday, and even into this morning. They agree, you know, this is very much about sending a signal and putting out that message that, you know, they hope will act as a kind of depressing factor on the number of people coming in, because they're just under such unimaginable pressure, and they see it, they do see it themselves as quite a failure that people had to sleep on the floor of Dublin Airport's old terminal building, and, you know, a failure of the state to provide, you know, one of the key factors that it has undertaken to provide to people who are in dire straits, which is that of shelter, you know.
I mean, this doesn't change Ireland's international obligations, right? Under asylum law, under international agreements that provide for states' obligations to take in people who are fleeing war or persecution and provide them with a safe haven. But the assumption in government, if I'm right, is that many of the people, excluding obviously people who come from Ukraine, are, you know, to use a term that sometimes you use pejoratively and attempt not to do so, they are economic migrants, and that they won't have a right to stay here under international law. But we want to dissuade them, or the government wants to dissuade them from coming in the first place so that they don't clog up the system. Is that what's going on?
Yes, it is, I think, to an extent. And you see a lot of discussion around this concept of a safe European country, you know, and people arriving from a safe European country. And I think what is being talked about when language like that is used is countries like Georgia. And in the conversations I've been having over recent days, Georgia is a country that comes up time and again, because there's been over 1,000 people, I think, this year so far applying for international protection from Georgia. And generally, I think that's not seen as an unsafe country. And last week, there was discussion about kind of effectively fast-tracking the international protection application for people like this. So, you know, from that jurisdiction in particular, and from other similar jurisdictions, so they might go through in a matter of months and effectively, you know, it looks like kind of be sent back. But I think what's more fundamentally important here, again, rather than the kind of nitty-gritty, is the signal that's being sent, and also the fact that the government is showing that it is looking for levers to pull on immigration policy that we haven't seen in quite some time. You know, they're not kind of like seismic fundamental reorganization where we are, as you say, in keeping with our obligations under international law, and it's not the Rwanda policy by any manner or means, but it is stepping out from a long-standing international agreement that only the UK and France have stepped out from before of the signatory countries. So we're now the third country to step out from it. The last country to step out from under it was at the UK almost 20 years ago. So I think it shows that, you know, Ireland and Irish public policy and all aspects, many aspects of kind of of social policy are being pushed to the pin of their collar by the pressures that are coming on from the migration crisis and from the fallout from the war in Ukraine. And this is just another example of the kind of disorder that is flowing from that and impacting things like inflation, the housing market, the wider economy. And should we really be surprised that migration policy is being revisited and shaken up and hardened up a little bit? Perhaps not, and perhaps there may be more to come.
And how close is that system of provision, not just for Ukrainians who are fleeing the war there, but other people arriving here seeking international protection? How close is that system? You referred to it earlier as being in danger, toppling over. I mean, just paint us a picture of how things are at the moment.
So it strikes me that it seems almost in a permanent case of being close to tipping over. You know, I was talking to somebody in government yesterday and they likened it to, you know, being in a ship where there's water coming on and it's just coming in as fast as you can bail it out. And 40,000 people being added in to an already stretched system has put it under untold pressures. But the fact is that those pressures are beginning to tell. And you see the kind of the cracks when, you know, effectively people have to sleep on the floor of Dublin Airport because the whole system is getting snarled up. The way the system works is people come in, they're triaged in a reception centre. You know, it used to be in Dublin Airport actually, and then it was moved to City West. And then the idea is that they're moved on to what is called emergency accommodation. Now, emergency accommodation in Ireland is by and large hotels. Yes, there is some kind of church halls and there's student accommodation as well, but like the vast majority of it is hotel accommodation. And the idea or the kind of the plan from there had been that those people would move on again into some kind of semi-permanent form of accommodation, most likely in pledged accommodation. But that flow of people through the system is not proving to be effective, you know. So you have a situation where the hotels are filling up or full, and the whole thing is just getting snarled up. And that's why I think, you know, we should get used to this kind of state of constantly being on the edge of collapse or constantly being in a state of near crisis until they manage to figure out some way of improving that flow. Because as ministers were warned on Monday, it doesn't look like, you know, the numbers of people coming into the other end of that funnel fleeing from Ukraine. And indeed, as I say, that commoner garden international protection applicant, it doesn't look like that's going to slow down at all. And in fact, they were told on Monday that, you know, it could well continue at the current rate of 1,400 odd people per week coming into the state seeking accommodation and protection. So, you know, there's a mismatch there between the number of people who are coming in and the number of people the system is seemingly able to accommodate. And I think that that's going to heap the pressure on government, not just in terms of solving the problem now, but more pertinently, when you look back at the modelling that was given to them in early spring, even these were the kind of numbers. In fact, they were projecting higher numbers than ended up arriving. So the charge that would be levelled at government would be, you were warned that this was coming. In fact, you were warned that it could well be worse than it is. And you don't seem to have identified any kind of practicable solution for accommodating these people on a semi-permanent basis, relying almost solely instead on expensive forms of accommodation like hotels. And that system is now, it seems, almost a breaking point.
And it's one thing putting people in tented accommodation that as an interim solution, but presumably once you head towards the winter, that's not really a viable safety valve. Similarly, lots of people being put into student accommodation in colleges and universities now, but the students will be back in September. They'll need that. So there's all these sort of pressures that are gathering in the middle distance. And I just wonder where that capacity comes from to deal with the existing numbers, not to mind the vista of, you know, 1,400 people a week coming between now and then.
Well, I think the pressure largely shifts from Roderick O'Gorman's Department of Integration to Dara Brown's Department of Housing, who were, you know,
it sounds like a hospital pass if there ever was one.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's not entirely unknown for ministers to ship each other hospital passes from time to time in government. But I suppose that, you know, the charge that Dara Brown would face is that at the same time as those warnings were coming in early spring and really from the start of this conflict, you should have been cognizant of this. And, you know, where are all the vacant buildings that could or should have been identified? So, you know, there was a list of, I think it was either 50 or 60 large vacant state-owned buildings that could have been converted into kind of dormitory style accommodation. I think that the questions that will be asked of him and his department is, why haven't you made more progress on those, and where are those, and things like modular housing?
And is that work ongoing now?
I don't know, to be honest, Pat. I mean, my understanding was that, like, there was a kind of a low-hanging fruit list of places that could have been turned in to a reasonable standard accommodation in a matter of months. And then there was a longer-term list, you know, that would be, you know, 8, 9, 10 months plus. But I think the pressure is certainly going to be coming on for those kind of solutions, and also for things like modular housing and temporary housing. What's been interesting as well is that because the domestic or the pre-existing kind of political pressure on housing has been so great, the Department of Housing and Dara Brian have been kind of looking for twofer style solutions, which, you know, things that could be adapted for the housing crisis, the refugee crisis now, and then potentially become part of the housing crisis solution further down the road. I don't know whether you can actually please those two masters, or whether you can, whether they're just going to have to kind of move ahead with things that are solely and bespokely for the Ukrainian situation. And of course, that begs the question and brings into sharper relief the issue of whether this very pressing crisis and the resources and time and political attention that is given to it necessarily means that you sacrifice resources, time and political attention given to those pre-existing pressures within the domestic housing crisis. You know, there are trade-offs, there are political choices in all this, and there are political costs in all this, and political costs of,
sure,
to failure.
Harry, if I can bring you in, we'll talk specifically about some climate stuff shortly, but there's an obvious kind of climate angle to the refugee crisis looming in the middle distance as well. And that's in, you know, increasing extreme weather in some parts of the world is going to lead to increased flows of people seeking refuge from that extreme weather into it. And, you know, particularly you can foresee the flows, or the attempted flows, of refugees from parts of North and East Africa into Europe increasing over, you know, over the coming decade or so. And that's something that European countries, including Ireland, are going to have to find a way of dealing with.
Yeah, I was on a trip to Africa in January 2020 when Leo Varadkar was still Taoiseach. He visited Mali and Ethiopia, and we visited refugee camps in Ethiopia at the time. I think there were 1 million refugees living in Ethiopia that had flowed in from surrounding countries over the previous years and decades. And one of the things that was said at the time that I thought was very interesting was that between now and 2050, there could be a potential flow of up to 1 billion people moving from arid continents like Africa, which have been affected by climate change, northwards to Europe and to other places. The argument that he was making at the time is that the only way that you can prevent that type of potentially catastrophic flow of people is by making the governments and economies and systems within African countries as robust as they possibly can be, so that people won't need to emigrate, essentially, and will have a decent standard of living in their own countries. And that's one of the big challenges that we face in the next generation.
But whatever happens, you know, in the longer term, you're going to have millions of people heading from some of these African countries towards Europe over the next decade. And Europe's current policy seems to be very much, you know, keep them out at any costs, not alone because their electorates won't put up with huge influxes of foreigners greater than they have already seen. I mean, it's a real policy challenge for not just the EU, but for member state governments, right?
Yeah, I think for any government that's, say, centrist or that's not extreme in either way, I think they have to try to find a balance between allowing people arrive who are seeking international protection, also allowing a certain number of economic migrants to come in because they're sometimes necessary for an economy, and perhaps it's the from a humanitarian perspective, it's sometimes the right thing to do. But the problem is that you have to try to put some kind of an upper ceiling on that or some kind of a threshold. And that's when it becomes problematic from a political perspective. You know, who plays God in these situations, and who are the people who decide what that upper threshold is? I mean, we've had an extraordinary, in a generation, I mean, when I grew up, you know, people from other countries were few and far between in Ireland. Now, every community in virtually every part of the country has a huge proportion of people who are either born in other countries or who were born here, but whose parents were born in other countries. So I think the demographics of Ireland is becoming more similar to that of other European countries and of America, which is one of our close comparators as well. I sometimes worry that we haven't prepared for it on a longer term basis. If you look at some of the problems that have arisen in places like Paris and places like London in relation to integration and this debate between integration and assimilation, they just haven't got it right. And one of the big difficulties they had in London, for example, is that for new communities with people who came from different countries, there weren't sufficient role models or sufficient encouragement for people to become fully integrated into society. So you had examples, for example, where the police force was predominantly white, didn't have enough people of, say, Caribbean or African heritage in them. And they have done some efforts to address that in recent years. And I think that we will have the same challenges ourselves, that we will have to ensure going forward that there is a mix and that all communities and all backgrounds are represented. Because one of the things that we don't want to do is to create the kind of, and again, it's a kind of a lazy term, but the kind of the ghettos that we have seen elsewhere in other countries. But at the moment, we have an immediate crisis because, as Jack was saying, you know, we have both people coming in from Ukraine, I think 40,000 in total, plus a 300% increase compared to 2019 of people coming in seeking international protection. And our problem at the moment is an acute one. We're just having difficulty finding accommodation for them. But that's not a problem that's unique to Ireland. I think every European country, particularly those close to Ukraine, have been encountering similar difficulties.
Part of the thing is, or part of the issue that we face in Ireland is that for kind of a political generation or perhaps more, migration policy had been kind of seen as a settled issue, notwithstanding the kind of stain of direct provision and attempts to kind of figure out a way of either improving that or ending that. But like, if you compare it to the early 2000s and the period immediately prior to the kind of collapse of the economy, where migration was a much more live wire issue when we had the referendum on citizenship and birth and so on and so forth. And it was the kind of thing that, you know, migration policy would have been, I think, prominently placed in party manifestos, I think, in the run up to the 2007 general election. But after the economy self-combusted, you know, economic migration became less of a thing, I think, and it became less of a kind of touchstone issue for Irish political discourse. And I think that even though you see migration politics surging to the fore in the EU from 2015 onwards, because the solutions that were largely put in place to deal with that inflow of migrants were kind of pro rata, and therefore because we're a smaller country, our share of those migratory populations was necessarily smaller. It didn't become a kind of third rail issue or a very you know, resonant political issue in Ireland. And because the changes of the last 18 months or so have been so rapid, be they post-pandemic or arising from the war in Ukraine, we're struggling, I think, to deal with that. And I think that that's why this intervention this week is so important, because we see migration policy being revisited as something that's kind of front and center of the political agenda, and then that to my mind hasn't happened for a while. So that's why I think it's new and interesting, problematic, you know.
And when you say migration policy, what you mean is a policy to control numbers, deter people from coming and control numbers, because ultimately the sustainability of any migration policy is to some degree a function of numbers, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, look, I'm no expert in migration policy or you know, the various ways in which it might manifest itself. But like,
yeah, don't talk yourself down.
it strikes me that, you know, it hasn't really been part of the conversation. It hasn't been something that, you know, aside from that direct provision issue, you know, the level of migration into the state hasn't been a big part of the discourse. And I just wonder whether that's going to be the situation going forward, and, you know, whether we're being pushed into such a kind of pressure point that there won't be kind of wider strategic discussions about what exactly migration policy in Ireland is, or immigration policy in Ireland is. Because if we have 40,000 people effectively stuck in hotels and no proper way to decant them out of hotels, and there's 1,400 people a week coming in on top of that, like, I mean, that does surely prompt that, or it should surely prompt, you know, a wider conversation about what are we doing here? How are we doing it? How are we going to achieve it? And, you know, what's the long or medium term exit plan to a more steady state, where presumably significant numbers of these people, because I don't think the war in Ukraine is ending anytime soon, so significant numbers of these people are going to, you know, have to be assimilated here, you know, and how does that look? And it comes back to the kind of things that the Harry was talking about, you know, he issued policing policing policy as an example, but they pop up all over society. The first instance I would imagine being, you know, if these people are to enter the private rental accommodation, how on earth are they going to access that? You know, we already have thousands of people stuck in direct provision who have permission to remain in the country and live and work here, but they stay in direct provision centres because they can't actually access the private rental sector. So, you know, problems just multiply no matter which way you look.
Never suffer the buffer again. Always stay connected with 99.9% reliable Sky broadband. Whether you're streaming on the sofa, gaming in the bedroom, or swiping in the bathroom. I said swiping. You'll never be without it. Switch your home to 99.9% reliable Sky broadband. Availability subject to location. Requires Sky Broadband Ultrafast. For more info, see sky.ie/speeds. 99.9% reliability based on time our broadband network works across our base.
Harry, I want to come to talk about climate issues. There's, I think we're at a particularly important point in the evolution of this government's climate action policy, but also in that process of all of Irish society being brought face to face with the changes that will be required in how we live, how we travel, how we heat our homes, how we produce our food. And those changes will be necessary if we are to reach the targets that are now set down in law of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2030. And there's an important meeting going on today between Eamon Ryan and Minister of Agriculture, Charlie McConlogue. Maybe just give us the background to that.
Yeah, well, a lot of it stems from the contribution that's expected of agriculture. And in the first instance, agriculture was asked to impose a lower ceiling on emissions reductions than any other sector. And the range for that was set out by the Climate Change Advisory Council was between 22% and 30%. That compares, for example, with 80% for electricity and about 50%, give or take, for sectors like transport and industry. Now, the difficulty is the actual first carbon budget is a year and a half in existence already. So it's only got 3.5 years of its first 5-year cycle to go, and the trajectory has been going up.
And it's supposed to come, obviously, it's supposed to come down by 4 or 5% a year, right?
51% between now and 2030, but less in the first 5 years and then more in the second 5 years. And that makes sense because, I mean, you can't pull a rabbit out of a hat. These things don't happen overnight. So to lower emissions sometimes takes many years in terms of just changing the infrastructure, changing the planning, changing practices and all of these things, and then trying to measure them. You know, some of these things can take 5 or 6 years before they can actually be implemented. So, I mean, there's no point in kind of saying we're going to go for 30% in agriculture now when we can't achieve 30% between now and 2030. It's physically impossible and it will be very difficult.
But if you don't do the 30% in agriculture, then you've got to do an awful lot more in transport or in industry or in power generation or whatever, right?
Yeah, transport is already 50%, so you probably need to go up to 70% in transport. You almost.
And in practical terms, sorry to keep jumping in on you, but in practical terms, that means things like more electric vehicles or fewer diesel cars on the road. And to get fewer diesel cars on the road, how do you do that? You jack up the tax on the cars to make it economically impossible for people. So these are not pain-free options, right?
No, I saw a headline in one of the newspapers over the weekend saying that every house that has a second car will have the second car robbed of it if the agricultural emissions are not met. So there's kind of scare headlines like that going out. But there will have to be some very tough medicine administered in one sector or another. The argument over agriculture has become a kind of almost like a cultural war, an internecine war between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on the one hand and the Green Party in government. And we've seen.
Which brings us back to this meeting today, right?
Yes. And I mean, essentially, we know that Fianna Fáil, the majority of Fianna Fáil TDs believe that 22% is the most that agriculture can go. Because if it goes more than that, you're going to be talking about culling some of the national herd. And that has become a huge touchstone issue for a lot of rural TDs and also for farming organisations like the IFA.
But the herd isn't going to be culled, though, right? I mean, it may be reduced over a period of time by way of incentives and our carrot and stick. But, you know, Eamon Ryan, no more than Eamon Ryan isn't going to come around and drive away in your second car, nor is he going to go out to your farm and shoot 20% of your cows, right?
No, but they will make it. As you were saying, that the trigger point will be the economic stimulus or the lack of economic stimulus that will be applied. So if they're going to go after diesel cars, they will make it very economically difficult for a person to run a diesel car. It'll become expenses. The taxes will go up. Perhaps the fuel levies will go up. They might introduce congestion charges in certain urban areas to incentivize people to move over from diesel to electric. And that's what they did, for example, in Norway. They made it so expensive for people to buy a new diesel car that they didn't really. And then they introduced extra incentives for people to buy electric cars.
Sure.
That they made the choice essentially a little bit easier for people. But it was still a very expensive proposition. You know, it's not that electric cars will suddenly become really affordable. They won't. They will still be very expensive. But people might be forced to pay out a little extra than they'd anticipated in order to make sure that they are still mobile. In relation to agriculture, if they go for a higher figure, sure, they won't be going out they won't be going out and driving herds into slaughterhouses, but they will be making it financially difficult for certain sectors within the livestock industry to maintain. And I'd say they would be gearing towards focusing more on beef production rather than dairy, because beef production tends to be a little bit less efficient in general than dairy production in Ireland. But Fianna Fáil say 22%, Green Party people say 30%. Eamon Ryan has been non-committal, and I think what's going to happen is that they're going to have a figure that might be a little bit above 22%, but won't be very much above 22%. The 30% that the Greens want, I don't think is going to happen.
The idea being, or the potential space for the fudge there being, that there are things you can do on land use, such as afforestation and rewetting, plus other aspects of land use. You can get maybe energy production on farms, and they could go towards reducing the target for both carbon dioxide and methane reductions on the in the agriculture sector. The idea being that they make contributions in other ways, right?
That's it, yeah, that's exactly it. So, I mean, it's a balancing act. But, I mean, if you look at it from an overall perspective, Pat, the 51% reduction by 2030 is going to be so hard to achieve. And I mean, even at this stage, I think it's doubtful that we will come anywhere close to 51%. And there are some easy wins that can be achieved, and there are some practices that can be changed very quickly. But to cut emissions by that much in such a short space of time, we're talking about 7.5 years, I just think is a very, very big ask. I'm not saying that it can't be done, but I'm saying it's going to be very, very difficult for us to do it.
Presumably it can be done as, you know, as a matter of physics. The question surely is whether there is public buy-in and therefore political will to make the sort of changes that would be required to do it. That is, vastly fewer car journeys, you know, maybe eating less meat, maybe less international air travel, all these sort of lifestyle changes that, frankly, I have my doubts that there is public, you know, overwhelming public backing for.
Well, we've seen it with the carbon tax. We've seen it with the increase in fuel prices. We've seen it with every measure that the government has tried to introduce to try to encourage a reduction in emissions. People do agree with the general proposition in relation to climate change. But when it comes to specifics, particularly specifics that have an impact on their own lives, you see a marked reluctance coming to the fore. So essentially, you are asking people to make sacrifices, maybe not monetary sacrifices, but changes in their lifestyles that will make things slightly less convenient, that will, you know, they mightn't be able to go on as many foreign holidays as they have. They might have to use public transport rather than jumping into a car to go to places. They might have to look at other forms of travel. Now, the Green Party are always very good at kind of presenting all that as a positive, but unfortunately, many people who are sitting in their cars view it very much as a negative. So there's a job of work to do there to convince people that such things can work. And there are some things that will work very well. I mean, you see technology and disruptive technology happening all the time. And when e-scooters first came in, I thought they were a complete scourge and I hated them. But now I have grudgingly began to accept that they are part of the solution. And if the government does succeed in getting its network of sustainable travel routes into place, and it's a very ambitious programme and it's going to take a long time. But once that's in place, say somebody who lives in Mycullen in Galway, which is about 10 kilometres away from the city, there's going to be a greenway from Mycullen into the city centre. So if they jump onto their electric scooter or onto their e-bike, they will have a traffic light free ride into Galway over 10 kilometres that will take about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be disruption free and it will be hassle free. So if things like that are allowed to give a little bit of room to breathe, I think they will work in time.
Plus, the government could presumably, to facilitate that, give a tax break on the rain gear that you would need approximately 50% of the time. Listen, we're running out of time, but Jack, I just want to bring you in again on a broader point, right? Because I think that this meeting today between Charlie McConlogue and Eamon Ryan, is not expected that they will alight on a figure that they can both live with today, but everybody that I've spoken to in and around government, some of whom are involved in this process, expect that some sort of a deal can be reached in time for the last cabinet meeting before the August break next week. And that will clear the way of getting the carbon budgets, the sectoral budgets signed off and to be implemented in the autumn. But in a way, I think this process of trying to find a landing ground that is acceptable to both the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael backbenchers and to the Green Party, this is the bargain that's at the very heart of this government, I think, in that the Greens entered government because they believed they could get implementation of climate action measures that was important enough, that was sufficient enough to make it worthwhile going into government and putting up with being in government with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, which wouldn't have been their first choice, and doing other things or not doing enough on some things that they might like to do. For Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, those backbenchers that'll be under pressure, not just from Sinn Féin and from independents in their constituencies, but from farming organisations and so forth, it has to, a deal has to be bearable for them as well. So in a way, this is a really important test of that bargain at the heart of government between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on one side and the Greens on the other. And if they can't make it, they can't make that deal stick, they can't find a deal that's acceptable to both sides that goes far enough for the Greens but not too far for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, if they can't do that, then this government's in trouble, I think.
I think so, yeah. It's in some ways the whole ballgame, really. And also the kind of the traditional Irish political approach to climate or environment policy is kind of off the table. That is the kind of meaningless fudge, you know, the rhetorical commitment to do something at some point in the future.
That won't wash anymore, I think.
It won't wash anymore. It won't wash with the Greens. And I think that, like, notwithstanding the grumpiness on the backbenches in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, I think there's probably an acceptance at leadership level, certainly within both those parties, that, like, you know, now is the time for action on climate. And if you want your legacy to be yet another government when confronted with the undisputable facts of climate change that effectively did nothing or kicked the can down the road, or do you want to be the government, you know, that at least made a start on, you know, a framework for addressing these problems? And I think that questions of legacy are particularly apparent for Micheál Martin, you know, coming to the end of his time in the Taoiseach's chair and coming to the end of his political career, more or less. There will be another act, who knows what it will be, but like, you know, he's you know, he is where he is. So I think all those factors come to bear, and, you know, there's important political personal brands, and, you know, I think political skill will be tested in all for all parties. Eamon Ryan faces a really interesting challenge here as well, because he has developed this kind of tendency for a bit of foot and mouth syndrome and to become negatively associated with unpopular interventions, which can broadly be seen as climate, and you know, he can sometimes say things that seem a little bit silly, and that reaches back into a long history of the Green Party doing things that look, you know, appealing to their ecological base, you know, but a bit silly to the wider population. You know, remember the stag hunting bill in the dying days of the Fianna Fáil Green government in 07 or 08, whenever it was. And then, you know, there's the other line ministers. You know, I think there's a big test for Charlie McConnellogue. You know, I think that his political style is not one that is kind of incandescent. He's more of a kind of manager.
Quite
the opposite. Yeah. You know, like, I don't think he himself would dispute that. In fact, I was talking to someone during the week who said, you know, he's more corner back than corner forward. But there's a place for that kind of that political style. And if it's proven to be effective, you know, being more managerial than, you know, superstardom, you know, if he can achieve an outcome here for his constituency groups or you know, the stakeholders, to use that awful phrase, mm-hmm. that fall under agriculture, be they political in terms of backbenchers or farming organizations, that also achieves the broader strategic goals of edging down the path towards climate sustainability, then I think he'll have seen to have come out of this with his reputation enhanced. If he doesn't do that, it'll be a big blow. And, you know, he's often one of those names that's floated as potentially being vulnerable to a cabinet reshuffle, I suspect, not because of anything he's done wrong, because he doesn't make an awful lot of mistakes, but more because he's not that kind of magnetic a character. But if he comes out of this, you know, with the reputation enhanced, that I think solidifies his position in cabinet come the end of the year. So, you know, all these different stakes are at play at all times. But when you take a step back from the kind of parlour games and the small p politics of it, like, it really matters. And as you say, it's at the core of the sustainability, not just of the climate, but of the government.
That's all for this week. This episode was produced for the final time before she leaves us by Jennifer Ryan. Jennifer, thank you for everything and best of luck in the future. We'll talk to you next week.
The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.